And we're back to Inside of Power Talk. And we have on the phone,
on line one here, live from suburbia Chicago, Imam W. Dean Muhammad. Thank you, sir, for being our guest this morning.
Thank you, Joy.
Well, look, we're really excited about having the opportunity to talk to you, and I realize that you're a very traveled man. You've been traveling around the globe quite a bit lately, haven't you?
Well, yes, a lot of traveling outside and inside, too. Inside the U.S. and outside. That's what I do mostly. And I do that because I think I can best serve the Muslims of the world, and particularly the Muslim of the U.S., by carrying the message of unity and peace, brotherhood, tolerance, and respect for others. I think I can do a better job by moving about rather than staying in one place. If I had enough money to buy enough time on radio and TV, I wouldn't have to move about so much.
Yes, ma'am. Understood. Anyway, for anyone just tuning in, our guest today, son of the late Elijah Muhammad, and now the Muslim religious leader, referred to as Imam, in the Society of Muslims of America, W. Dean Muhammad. And he's our guest by phone this morning. Imam Muhammad, you have been credited as really transforming the black Muslim. Can we talk a little bit about that? I mean, we've moved from nationalism with Islam in America to a broader perspective now. Could you share with our listeners just a little bit as to what direction you feel in the past 20 years the Muslim in America under your leadership has moved in?
Yes, what explains? It's a very complicated, history and a very complicated idea to explain. When we are talking about the Nation of Islam, the Temple of Islam, called also the Nation of Islam in America. But it's easier to understand if we understand that circumstances really kind of dictated what was formed as the Temple of Islam or the Nation of Islam. And the circumstances, number one, was that at that time we still had two Americas, a black America and a white America, an African American, white America, and a European America. And many of us knew that we didn't have equal citizenship in this country. Our citizenship wasn't worth near as much as white citizenship. And some will say even today our citizenship is not worth as much as white citizenship. But what I'm getting at is this, that in the Temple of Islam, a Nation of Islam, it began in around 1931 in the depressed area of Detroit, African-American neighborhoods. It began with the most culturally deprived supporting it, and the poorest of the people of the city supporting it. I remember senior citizens in our group, in our religious community, being the biggest donors or the biggest contributors to the financial support. And I recall them, those that were given that big amount of money, being what we called back then junk men. And they could even afford a horse to pull their load of scrap metal and glass and cardboard. And during World War II, there was a demand for all that stuff, you know. So they could take the broken glass, whatever, and scrap metal and cardboard waste, and other things, and even paper, newspaper, brought them pennies, and they became the biggest support for the temple. They were very devoted people. And those were the circumstances back there. We hardly had one college graduate for most of the life of the Nation of Islam in America. We hardly had one college graduate. It was only late in the history of the Temple of Islam or the Nation of Islam that the Honorable Elijah Muhammad starts to attract some people who are more literate and a better status in society. That was very late in his life, like in the 60s, in his mission, like in the 60s. And by the 70s, he did have an official staff. Most of them, at least 50% of them, they had college education or some college education. And he had a few degreed people. Maybe there were about five to ten degreed people we could count in the whole the membership during the 70s of our Elijah Muhammad's leadership. So these are the circumstances. During the 30s, we know the Great Depression was there, And you can imagine how poor African Americans were faring during that time. A preacher by the name of Father Divine was already preaching that he was like Christ, and he was God, and his followers were taking him to be God. I think he was just accepting to be called Father Divine, but his followers, they carried a little further, and they said, Father Divine is God. So the teacher of the Honorable Elijah Muhammad, he came in at that time, when most Americans were already teaching a kind of esoteric, secret, symbolic, hard to understand idea they called Islam. It was not Islam. It was an attempt to have Islam. So this man called Farad, Farad, W.D. Farad, he came and he put his stuff together. And he used W. Ali's Moorish American ideas of it. And he used Father's Divine idea, black man being God. And he used a lot of other things that he got even from his country in the Far East. He came from India, what's called Pakistan now. At that time, it was called India. Before 1947, it was called, all of it was called India. So he came from that part of the Far East. And he brought a lot of the ideas with him from religious myths in that part of the world, too. He put something together with good intentions, I do believe, something that he knew would be so fascinating, so strange, that it would capture the attention of blacks who wanted something else. They wanted an alternative. And it worked. He called it magnetism. And it worked. I believe he didn't intend for us to hold on to that. He meant for us to call ourselves Muslim and want to be Muslims. And he left the Quran, our holy book, Quran, with us, with my father. And in hopes that as the circumstances would improve for us living as equal citizens in this country, that more better informed people with more education and more knowledge of the world culture and et cetera, would come in, and they would be able to kind of decode or take the mystery out of the temple of Islam's religion and find their way to the Quran. I believe that was the scheme. And I took up a lot of time to say that, but that was very important for me to say that.
Sure, and I did want you to have the opportunity to say that. For anyone just tuning in, we have W.D. Muhammad, the Muslim religious leader, the Imam, the Honorable Muhammad, is our guest today by phone out of Chicago live. Imam Muhammad, let's talk a little bit then about this whole notion of nationalism and its place in history and where you see the impact of nationalism with the African-American community now.
Yes. There was not the black nationalists called black nationalists. We were always in the minority, but we were very strong in certain places, like in New York and Harlem. Black nationalists were very strong in Ohio and a few other places, very strong. But we were always in the minority. In the minority, never did the majority of African Americans buy black nationalism. But I believe that those who became black nationalists, they experienced something that I believe most people need to experience, but can't feel that they belong to the land and the people that they are with. We are Americans, and this land is America, U.S. We have to either identify with it in a healthy way, in a positive way, to progress. We can go a little ways down the road, but if we want to be able to make it with the great majority of American citizens down the road of progress, we have to have an appreciation for the land, appreciation for the people, appreciation for the Constitution of these United States, for this form of democracy, etc. So in my opinion, black nationalism, though it separated us from sensitivities like that, or interests like that, it at the same time tried to build up in us a sense of nation, a sense of government, a sense of national aspirations and disciplines, and even governmental disciplines. And that particular focus, I think black nationalism has served us very well. I'm not excluding the respect that it tried to build in us for our motherland, Africa, and the people and our people in Africa that we descended from. Right today, I don't see black nationalism as having much of, I would say, a presence or a future, because circumstances have greatly changed. We don't have to now look outside to Africa or to anywhere else or to think of separate states. We are on the books, the law books. We are given the same rights that other people are given in this country. And what's left for us to do now is just work hard to establish ourselves, as our Elijah Muhammad put it, to establish for ourselves the same respect that other people are establishing for themselves or want to establish for themselves. That's all we have to do now.
Now, when you talk about, certainly, you know, you're the son of the Honorable Elijah Muhammad. What is your perspective on the place in history and the significance of the African-American progression to where we are now? Looking back, certainly, you know, you were there, you were in the nation with your father. Exactly how do you think that history should be written about him from your perspective?
Yes, I think he should be, first of all, he's beginning to be recognized more and more by the professional class of African-American people as the man, as the one man who shocked the conscience of the black man as well as the white man in America, and caused African-American people to have the courage to look at things and to ask questions that they never asked before, and to have courage to contend with the white world that wanted to shut us out, in a more manly way than they had before. And this new sense of our manhood, we owe a lot of that to the Honorable Elijah Muhammad's leadership.
Certainly, and as a follower of history, would have to recognize that there's so much truth in that. What about also, you know, in his message to a black man? I wonder how much would that message be altered now if he were to write that as we are nearing the end of this millennium, getting ready to go into another one?
Well, I'm gonna say something. I don't know how many friends I'm going to win, but I'm going to say this. If the Honorable Elijah Muhammad was here today, knowing his strategy, knowing how he gradually softened his language as the country became more, I would say, humane and more decent toward African Americans, I would say if he was here, knowing what he expected out of me as his son, I would say that the Honorable Elijah Muhammad would say, put the book in the museum and listen to my son, Wallace D. Muhammad.
So that was something that was relevant for that period and place, the time in history, and now you're saying that we need to move on.
That's exactly what I'm saying.
And I find it interesting because, laterally, or either, shall we say, you know, you have, shall we say, spiritual brothers that are products of the nation that might, you know, adhere a little closer to the former teachings or, you know, some of the former thought.
I didn't get the...
Well, I was trying to clean it up. I was
I didn't get the expression.
I was just trying to say that, you know, there are Muslims in America that would hold on to some of the former teachings a little closer.
Oh, certainly.
Right.
Certainly. There are. And there are some that feel they have to. They feel that the condition of the African American poor, is such that they need that strong wine to drink, you know?
Right.
But Muslims are not supposed to drink strong wine.
Okay.
Or strong drinks, period.
Understood. Now, you have been credited as establishing genuine dialogue between the leaders of Islam, Christianity, and Judaism worldwide, particularly here in America. What is your perspective on that? Because that's something that certainly was not of a form of thought.
Yes, it's all part of my interest and strategy. I have an interest to open up the world to Muslims in America, open up America mainly, to Muslims in America and to African American Muslims. And to do that, I think we have to open every door that's very important for us in America. And that Christian community is a great majority, in the great majority in America. They represent the establishment in America more than anybody else. The Jew is influence is very, very big and great and important. Though their numbers are not near as large as the Christians, and their numbers are not too much larger than ours, about the same maybe as ours. But they are very, very important because of how they have been able to use the legal system and progress in all the important areas of this life's establishment, of this country's establishment, education, colleges, universities, you name it, authoring books, contributing to the progress of science, being strongly represented there, having political clout because of financial strength and political, I would say, political wisdom, or savvy, or whatever we want to call it,
right.
They are very strong, and they have great financial holdings, too. So they are very strong, and they have a strong hold on our country. Our country feels a debt to them, and I'm not condemning that. I think if we look at the history of our country, of our government relationship with the Jewish people, our Jewish community, we can understand why they have so much influence and so much power to bring our government give them support in Israel, or give Israel support, you know. So that's understandable. I'm not saying it to condemn it, but I'm just saying that they are very powerful people. So we can't ignore these powerful people. We can't ignore the Christians. We can't ignore the Jews. We have to live in this country. And the Islam, as I understand it from our holy book, the Quran, and as I understand it from our prophet, the prophet of Islam, Muhammad the prophet, who we call, our scripture calls him a mercy to the world. If he's a mercy to the world, then that tells us that we have to be interested in the whole world too. So we have to have feelings for the whole world. We have to want to make a contribution to all people and not exclude any people. We have to compete. We have to be competitive. So to be competitive, we need to make ties. And Islam again tells us in our holy book that we should form ties. And some learned scholars in Islam, they may say, well, these ties are to be formed only with Muslims. But if we look at the history of the Prophet of Islam, 14 centuries ago, he formed pacts and he negotiated with pagans, idolaters, people who worship idols, that we call pagans. So why shouldn't we want to have ties with Christian people, people who have faith in God and believe in the judgment? So we should want to have ties with these people. We should want to be the friends of these people. Our religion teaches us to respect their religion, to respect the book that was revealed to them, and to see them as a people of faith. So there's much for me to say, but I'm just going to conclude there. So it's part of my strategy. That's part of my strategy, to meet with the Jews and dialogue with them.